Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midwestern Archaeology Podcast. My name is Lee Strange, and today we're talking about one of the most remarkable cities in North America and the Midwest's history, Cahokia. This Mississippian metropolis, located just outside modern-day St. Louis, rose rapidly in the 11th century, becoming a hub of ceremony, politics, and agriculture, only to largely be abandoned a few centuries later. What drove its rise? What caused its fall? And what can this ancient city tell us about the links between climate, culture, and resilience? To guide us through these questions, we're joined by Dr. Timothy R. Pocketat, one of the foremost authorities on Cahokia and ancient North America. Dr. Pocketat is the new director of the School for Advanced Research and a senior scholar. He's also former Illinois State Archaeologist and professor of anthropology and medieval studies at the University of Illinois. A prolific scholar, Dr. Pocketat has authored or edited over 17 books, including his latest, Gods of Thunder, How Climate Change, Travel, and Spirituality Reshaped Pre-Colonial North America. His work brings together archaeology, religion, astronomy, and environmental science to offer bold new interpretations of ancient cities and their worlds. Dr. Pocketat, thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So before we jump into the discussion about Cahokia, I'm curious about your own journey, Tim. Were you always interested in archaeology, or was there something that you thought you might do before archaeology?
I did want to do archaeology from a very young age, like 8 or 9. But I also wanted to do a bunch of other things when I was 8 or 9. And they included paleontology, they included journalism, they included being a musician, you know. So I think over the years, by the time I was a teenager, I was really much more into archaeology, in part because I grew up on what remained of an old farm. And on and around that old farm, you know, there were archaeological sites, pre-contact Native American archaeological sites. So you'd find arrowheads in the field, for instance. And that's how I got my start. At some point, 7th or 8th grade, I think we lived maybe half an hour from the Cahokia site itself.
Oh, wow.
And we took a field trip there. And after that point, after that field trip, I really was more committed to trying to understand, like, how could I have grown up in a place where there's this ancient city, you know, just a half an hour away? And that became, my life's work.
Did you know that Cahokia was going to be what you were going to study? Or was there more of a process of finding out research topics and stuff like this? Or did you know from the start that you wanted to study Cahokia?
I think I detoured away from Cahokia a bit, and it was possible as a grad student in archaeology later that I could have detoured completely away from it. There were some opportunities that I had that just never, either they didn't materialize or I didn't pursue them for other reasons. And so in the end, Cahokia was this thing that I, as a grad student at the University of Michigan, I still knew pretty well. And my advisor said, just do that. So ultimately, then I stuck with it, right?
Gotcha. So just kind of, now that I'm curious, what was the state of Cahokia research when you first got into the field? And how does the field look today in terms of Cahokian research?
You know, when I first started, there were several researchers who were exploring the problem of urbanism. Like, was Cahokia urban or not? A guy named Mike Fowler, Robert Hall, and some others. And interestingly, that discussion actually went away for a while as archaeologists turned more towards thinking about agriculture and ecology. And they kind of forgot about urbanism, and some even rejected it as a useful idea to apply to a place like Cahokia, believe it or not. And there's some biases in there, probably some Western biases in there, you know, at the same time. But what we really didn't have a good handle on when I started, even though there were some notions about urbanism that I came back to, was history. Like a tighter history. Like, how did this thing happen? And then, you know, along the way, what changes? And you know, in terms of social history, you know, is everybody into this, or is there, whether there's a resistance, or like, and then what makes it fall apart, historically understood. And I think when I started, well, I guess it was the early 80s, There was still this more general feeling like, well, societies like this evolve, so you don't necessarily need to know the specific history. Just think about the big factors like, well, you know, corn agriculture leads to a city, leads to exploitation of your environment, and then it all collapses. That's changed. We have now a much more nuanced historical understanding that at least acknowledges and sometimes even connects with actual people in the past or what those people did. And then you can infer about human beings and how one person or one event, one celestial event, let's say, you know, can change history. And then, and how do people deal with that afterwards? And I think it's hard to overstate, actually, how important Cahokia is to the global understanding of early cities, because we know so much about Cahokia in those historical terms now that most people in other parts of the world don't, with respect to the cities they're studying.
Okay, so let's just jump into Cahokia as a topic and as a site. Can you give us a brief introduction about why Cahokia is, as you said, such a pivotal site in North American archaeology, where the site is located today, and just a little bit more of an introduction about what Cahokia is exactly?
Cahokia, or Cahokia Mounds, as it sometimes is called, especially as a state park, is, relative to other civic and ceremonial centers of its time, is actually in a slightly odd location. It's at the northern end of this, or the northern edge of the southeastern United States, north of the Mason-Dixon line, whereas other things like it, sometimes labeled the Mississippian culture, almost all to the south. So that's always struck researchers as weird. And then you add on top of that, like, yeah, and Cahokia was probably the first Mississippian civic ceremonial complex, certainly city, and the other ones are slightly later, and they riff off of Cahokia because it happens first. So you have this sort of singularity that develops in a place that seems odd, and it's also odd that it's early. And when I say early, not that early relative to the history of the continent, but it starts developing during the beginning of the medieval climate optimum, which is around 900 AD or so. And it isn't really there yet. It begins as a village that grows into kind of a mega village by 1050. And then at 1050 AD or CE, the place is reorganized into a, what you might think is a big urban monumental center. And that lasts from 1050 to around 1250, 1350. Things actually are going downhill beginning as early as 1200, even a little earlier. And things are changing after that. And then by 1350, the place is mostly depopulated. So that's late in the history of the continent. I mean, there are mounded sites and ceremonial centers that go all the way back to at least 5,000 BCE, and especially around the Gulf Coast. One that people look to often as a good example is Poverty Point in Louisiana. Just an incredible place. And it's probably not permanent. I mean, it's occupied seasonally, probably by lots of people. And that kind of seasonal occupation, where you have a center with say big mounds, you see from 5,000 all the way to Cahokia, but they're never permanent urban complexes. They are more like the centers of a dispersed community of hunter-gatherers and or later farmers living all around, and they go in for ceremonies into the center, to be around the mounds.
Curious about the stories buried beneath your feet? The Archaeological Research Institute, ARI, is your gateway to exploring the past right here in the Ohio River Valley. From hands-on digs to immersive exhibits and cutting-edge research, we make archaeology real. Discover the power of the past. Visit explorearI.org and start your journey today.
that's what changes significantly then at 1050. When Cahokia is built, it goes beyond that. It goes into an actual urban phenomena where there's somebody has a sense of order, and then people migrate in and they stay, and it has a big population. So Cahokia then at the beginning has the city and its three precincts. It's kind of this unusual sprawling city that's hard to draw a line around. Has about 20,000 people at the beginning, and that's huge. Wow. And it was even bigger than some Mesoamerican cities, where it's probably also drawing some inspiration from those as models, at least indirectly. And so that makes it unique historically. And then you can expect, like, wow, so what happens in a world where people all of a sudden have a city with that many people? What are its impacts? And with that question in mind, you can start looking at the histories of these other places that I said exist mostly to the south.
Yeah.
And start creating a bigger continental history of how places and the people of those places, since they're traveling and they're migrating, impact other parts of the continent. And that becomes really interesting.
So as I was reading some of your articles and other people's articles regarding the beginning of Cahokia, something that really stood out to me was that many people, including yourself, have characterized Cahokia's kind of beginning as abrupt. And amongst the agricultural societies of the Upper Mississippian kind of area. And I'm just curious if you can kind of shed a little bit more light about why that is and just give us some more information about the beginning of Cahokia as it emerged out of these kind of larger towns and villages that were found there.
Yeah. That the general question of like the abruptness and then the rate and the scale of development is pretty much sums up my career. Like that is what I've been fascinated by. Because in our world where we have cities that kind of slowly expand, you know, and it doesn't seem normal. Now, there are examples where you have Cahokia-like things in the American historic period. Yep. But we don't think about those as the classic city. Cahokia, I've been convinced most of the evidence shows that there was this abrupt moment when you went from what was before, which I'll talk about here in a sec, to then this planned, designed, monumental grounds that is like just huge. On a global scale, it's huge. And certainly it must have blown people's minds at the time when they were themselves helping to build it. Like, I would imagine they're thinking, what are we building here? And but also maybe being very proud and very drawn to the fact that they were doing something that was connecting to the gods in a whole new way and a whole new scale that had some real benefits to it. Now, but let's go back to what was before. Since the Middle Woodland period, since 2,000 years ago in the Midwest, where you had lots of mound building, those mound builders, were doing domesticating crops, local crops, and doing a horticulture or maybe a low-level agriculture. Not clearing fields so much, but certainly maintaining gardens and occasionally having a field next to your village. And the crops were a lot of the things that farmers today call weeds, you know, like amaranth and goosefoot and
Quinopodium.
Yeah.
Yep.
And may grass and sunflower. But what they didn't have was corn. And what we know now, and this is, we've gone through another cycle of debate about this, but corn seems new at 900. They may have known about it. Somebody somewhere may have been experimenting with it, but they weren't really growing it till 900. And then you really start seeing the population in multiple locations around the Mississippi Valley. One of those is the area that becomes Cahokia. Start to attract people, just a few hundreds maybe, And then there these villages, which were amounted to small thatched roof houses about the size of a, I'm looking around here, but the size of a really big bathroom today in our houses,
okay,
or a really a small living room. Let's see, 5 by 3 meters. Not too big. And they're planting poles in the ground. Each family probably built their own house by digging holes, putting poles, and then roofing the whole thing with thatch. And they'd live in a village where there's maybe a number of houses like that around a courtyard. And then as these villages were growing, and the one at Cahokia was growing then, starting at 900, you just add more courtyards of other families and their thatched roof houses. By the early 1000s, you've got a village on the side of Cahokia and then a few other locations nearby of up to 2,000 people.
Wow.
Which is a lot of courtyards strung together.
Mm.
But they're still family or kin-based, you know, and there's no public architecture, no big buildings, you know, where you go in like for a church or anything like that. At the very end, you may see the first little low platform mounds being built, but even that, there weren't many of them. And they may have been borrowing that notion from folks who migrated up from the south down Missouri Boot Heel, Arkansas, Kentucky, mm-hmm. Tennessee, up the Ohio a little bit, maybe. And I've always thought that, you know, but like at about 1040, these folks were still not quite aware of what was coming just in the next 10 years. And the transition is not only abrupt, but it's a change in an order of magnitude. So they go from a really big village, which was impressive, of maybe 2,000 people, to this grand space with a plaza that's 50 acres that somebody imagined. They, hey, let's build a plaza. And by the way, on the end of this, let's put, you know, the North America's largest pyramid, and they start building it. Mm. And then they connect that large pyramid to a watery area to the south of the main plaza via a big earthen causeway. Big causeway being maybe a meter or so high and about the width of a four-lane street or four-lane highway. So it's like, wow. And those are dated now. Those, and we have pottery from those things. So the plaza, the causeway, and probably the lowest levels of that big platform mound, Monk's Mound, are the beginning.
Mm.
And there's probably like a bunch of these other platforms. Ultimately, the place has 200 platform mounds, which is a lot.
Yeah.
a lot of those are also being constructed at that beginning. So you have this mass amount of human energy poured into this construction phase where there's a whole new order, you know, with the pyramids, big plazas, causeways, and neighborhoods we now know. So they seem to have dissolved the little courtyard communities. People moved into more complicated, probably just move just right next door into more complicated laid out neighborhoods that have, and we know this based on excavations at East St. Louis, that have grids where there's public buildings plopped on a grid system. Mm. And then how people just build new houses around the public buildings in what really is a neighborhood.
Wow.
All new at 1050.
That must be so perplexing as an archaeologist and a researcher on this site to see this level of vision and grandeur, almost unprecedented in America, north of Mesoamerica.
It is. And there's always a cry for more radiocarbon dates because, of course, we want to figure out like exactly over what span of time did they do this? And circumstantial evidence, given what's where and how things do or don't overlap, always has led me to think it's within the span of a human generation. It's 20, 25 years. And then, of course, they keep building as they go forward. Mm. But that plan is laid out, this plan where you have a city that covers, it's in three precincts. So there's the big Cahokia precinct, then there's an adjacent East St. Louis precinct, and then there's probably this another one right across the river in St. Louis. Mm. Those precincts are all laid out and they cover between Skokie is probably about 6 square miles, and then the whole shebang is 10 to 15 square miles of sort of laid out space that somebody is imagining. That, you know, there's an order that defines that space, which is incredible amount of work, if nothing else.
Yeah, and that leads me to my next question, actually, regarding coordination of building efforts, and that also sort of deals with social stratification as well. So do we see an elite kind of coordinating this coalescence and construction of the Cahokian site and these different precincts, as you said? And is this elite class, the ruling class of later Cahokian society?
A really good question. The answer is yes, but modified from what we used to think. So we used to look for, in the earlier villages, like evidence of some powerful family. And there may be some hints of that. Some houses and some of the courtyards in these pre-Mississippian, sometimes called terminal late woodland villages, are a little larger. One courtyard has a little bit bigger, but they're not visually that much bigger. So it's not like they're standing out so much at all. What does stand out is that some of the villages around the periphery are smaller and have fewer people and don't engage the other villages as much as the people of Cahokia and East St. Louis, kind of these two big contiguous villages, did. And you can see this through pottery. You can see that people are coming in and bringing their pots that they made at their home village, maybe that's several miles out, coming into festivals at these bigger villages. And then they leave their pots behind, or they break them there, one or the other. They use them to cook food, and they probably stay a little while, a few days, and then go home. So it looks like people are already kind of, there must be somebody who's more influential, families that are a bit more, you know, connected and are more prestigious by virtue of the fact that those are the villages that are big and those are the ones that people go to for parties. There is some hints in the very first mortuary complexes at Cahokia itself, the ones that are probably like right date to 1050, if plus or minus, these public mortuary events, that there were already people alive in, you know, who would have come up, would have been growing up in this pre-Mississippian era. Obviously, there were people who transitioned between the two. Who were then right there at the beginning, and they have valuables, you know, they have powerful materials that are buried with them, and they're buried in suggestive ways, suggesting that it is families, like male and female and kids, that are right there. So to answer your question really quickly about were there, elites? Yes, but they wouldn't necessarily have identified themselves initially before Cahokia as elite. They just would have been like more influential families. Those people do seem to be the ones in who somebody among them is a planner and is a visionary, and they in probably in some larger council kind of situation imagine this new reality and build it, which is, and that's still then stunning. Like, how do they do that? And it's not through physical violence for the most part. There's some evidence that some people are eliminated at the very beginning, not many though. But mostly it looks like people happily pour in, migrants just by hundreds to thousands move to Cahokia, which suggests they want to be there. So then the big question is, well, especially from if you try to take or like collaborate with descendants and think like, well, what would be the motivating force 1,000 years ago that resonates with descendants today? And it is belief. You know, it's spiritualism. It's the ability for people, whatever your stage in life, whether you're one of the influential families or you're not, can come to this place and be in an environment that puts you closer to the gods. And that drives migration, that drives people's complicity, you know, and also like encourages them to devote what must have been each family must have contributed a lot of labor on all these monuments to help build it. And that is something that we don't identify with so much today because, you know, we're a capitalist world and our motivations are different than this kind of religious devotion that we see in the past. And you saw it other places in the past, whether you're in Europe or Asia or in the Americas.
Yeah, and that's really interesting to hear that violence wasn't necessarily a part, or at least a huge part, of Cahokia's initial coalescence. I hear you when you say that there was possibly some purges. And I understand that at this time in Cahokia's history, politics were kind of done on this feasting basis where people from smaller surrounding villages would go visit the larger villages, and that it was seems to be elective in a way. But was there ever any sense of tribute being offered to these more prestigious towns and villages that comprised the core of Proto-Cahokia?
Well, that doesn't mean there wasn't both of the things you just mentioned. That is, and then of course these things will change after this initial coalescence. Yeah. So tribute, that's a tricky one because what is it? And it could be something like, hey, you owe me, bring this food or else. And you know, and that maybe you call that tribute. And people think that, oh God, I got to do this and I don't like it, but you know, he's the big boss. So I'm going to do this. It could be like, well, what if you really want to support the people who have brought you this reinvigorated way of living where you are realizing the blessings of the water and the wind gods, you know, or the fertility gods. And you think, yeah, I want to keep this up. I'm going to contribute. Is that tribute or not? It's like, it depends on your perception. And I think later in time, people might have perceived it differently. Now, 100 years on, they might have thought, why am I paying tribute? But at the very beginning, I bet they didn't think of it that way. You know, even though maybe they even gave more at the beginning. So it's just it becomes a semantic argument, which is an important one because... Later, if you have resistance to tribute, that could spell doom, you know, earlier, if they didn't perceive it that way, then everything's good, you know, and you just keep it rolling. Same thing with military. I could see a military component to the early part. I mean, we do know there are some people who were killed and they show up in ways that look like, well, they're enemies. And maybe even, you know, from local enemies and they are killed. So, or they could have been little excursions out to say, look, we're Cahokians. We're going to control this river. We are the center of the universe. And so fall in line, please. Or maybe come to Cahokia and play a game. And if you don't like that, then you're going to be in danger here. I could see some military side to that.
Power projection.
That establishes peace and order on the river, and Cahokians might have thought that's our job. We're working with the gods. There should be peace and order, kind of like the Romans, you know. But outsiders might have perceived it differently.
And I'm sure that perception changed through time. It's just really interesting that in where ARI is located, it's kind of the Ohio River Valley, which is part of that Central Ohio Hopewell area where this kind of Hopewell religious movement started. And it's interesting, and just in contrast to the Cahokian movement, there was not as much of a centralized movement. So there's not really a ground zero in the way that there is in Cahokia, where you can trace it to a single generation or at least a generation or two. I mean, in Ohio, you might have the Scioto River Valley for the Hopewell, but it's still just very interesting.
I think that's right. That's a big difference. The absence of urban populations, you know, in the Hopewell, they're just not there. I mean, people are living scattered. Yeah. I have heard Brad Lepper describe Newark as this possible instance, something like Cahokia, where somebody had late in the Hopewell era had come up with this idea of like, let's just gather all of the really cool you know, powerful things in the whole Hopewell world, and let's put them all in one place. And it happens in this hypothetical scenario that he lays out quick. And so that could be a version of this, but it's still not based, like Cahokia is, on all of these migrants. It's still based more on pilgrimage, you know, and the Hopewell. In Cahokia, there are pilgrims and there are pilgrimages, but there's also this big migration and a resident population that has to be sustained. Yeah. Another thing, let me throw this in there right here. The second part of the last 20 years or so, or a little less, I became fascinated with, okay, so there's these outlier sites that go from, you know, Western Wisconsin all the way down to Mississippi and Louisiana that have Cahokian artifacts. We didn't know much about them. Like, what are they? And when are they there? And what are they doing there? So since 20 years ago, myself and colleagues worked in Wisconsin for 3 or 4 years. And most recently, I worked with a grad student in Mississippi. And what we have found, again, unlike Hopewell, is that Cahokians, when they're building this city in the late 1000s, are also going and traveling to far-off locations and setting up little Cahokian shrines. I say little because Cahokia is so big. These still can be pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And then occupying those places and then going home, it looks like, and then occasionally coming back and reoccupying and going home. And we know we have several of these now. There's probably more that we just don't know about, which suggests the city of Cahokia and those Cahokians have an agenda, and they are exploring their known world, I think, to define who they are back home, you know, to create this powerful place back home, not like Hopewell at all.
It's just really interesting that even hundreds of miles away in our neck of the woods, where in contemporaneous times you had Fort Ancient villages, Cahokian goods and materials show up occasionally at these sites. So it's just interesting that Cahokia has this kind of massive cultural radiance that spreads across the continent.
Yeah. I think they successfully managed to define that city as the archetype, you know, of then a way of life that happens afterwards, where it's driven by corn agriculture and their resident populations at the civic ceremonial centers. And that is a model that Cahokians define and then actively spread. Yeah, yeah. And of course, at Fort Ancient villages, you know, it's generally a household or maybe two of those folks who go in. But otherwise, it's still the more traditional Fort Ancient way of life, you know, happening there.
Right. From what I understand, Fort Ancient culture was thought to at one time be a Mississippian culture, heavily influenced by Cahokian and later Mississippian culture. And now that's not really kind of considered to be the case. It was its own sort of culture group, but it was definitely a neighbor and had some influence from Western Mississippian cultural influences. But I did want to kind of ask you before I turn to our discussion about lifestyle and how people lived in the city, I did want to ask you about the Richland Farming Complex. So can you tell us a little bit what that is and just kind of give us an understanding about the Richland Farming Complex?
Let me start this by linking together the very first question that you asked me about, where I came from. I got into archaeology with the Cahokia narrative. And it just turns out that, so I grew up in a little town, mostly south of Cahokia, in a sort of a traditional German immigrant farming area with multiple German. And so one of the things I found as a kid was little Cahokia artifacts in fields around my house. I didn't know what they were at the time. But later I came to realize, there's Cahokian settlements out here where I grew up. What are they doing there? And then as information accumulates through a number of folks' projects, cultural resource management or other research projects, you realize like there's actually kind of a lot of Cahokian settlements out here in the farmlands that are sometimes called the uplands around this big stretch of floodplain that Cahokia is situated in. And at the time that I became a professor then, a number of those were being destroyed. There are laws that protect sites in Illinois, and they're pretty good laws, but there are ways of getting around laws, or accidents happen. Somebody bulldozes a landform. It's like, oh my God, like there's a village over here. And so for several years, I pursued the excavation of those villages that were being kind of slowly wiped out as the Metro East, Metro St. Louis area kind of expanded. Mm. And we realized, I think, doing that, and we convinced others that there are a lot of farmers out in this Richland complex. Mm. And it's the Richland complex is where the forests of the area, the bluffs, meet the Illinois prairie, which comes down and comes real close to the floodplain right outside of Cahokia. And it seems like that zone, well, I know it has super rich soils. Mm-hmm. Even the first European farmers who moved in, like, went there and farmed it until they exhausted it for a while. So it looks like Cahokians did the same when they founded their city. One of the first things that happened, besides traveling up and down the river, was sending farmers out into this ecotone where there's rich prairie soil, and they set up a series of villages. And then they also looks like they sent out and set up small groups of Cahokian administrators sitting in the middle of these villagers.
Wow.
We happened to, because it was being destroyed, we excavated over 5 years one village that was clearly immigrant farmers from the Boot Heel of Missouri.
Wow.
And it's not tough at all to identify. They come with their Missouri pots and all their Missouri tools and the Missouri house styles, and they just set up shop.
Wow.
And that kind of revolutionized how we were thinking about Cahokia as this thing that happens fast. And then they actively, you know, increase their agricultural output and actively explore the Mississippi Valley, all to build this, you know, impressive city. I forgot what the original question was that I kind of went off on a...
Oh, I think you answered it. It was just about the Richland farming complex's relationship to Cahokia, its economy, because from what I understand, based off what you just told me, it was supplied Cahokia's needs and other things like that. So how close was the Richland farming complex in relation to Cahokia?
It's not far. It's a halo almost that wraps around about 15 miles out from the city of Cahokia. Now, I mean, granted, their most important farmlands were the floodplain fields all around Cahokia, you know, 15 and more miles away. But this halo kind of wraps up into this upland area where there's this prairie edge soil, and that's about 15 miles out now, plus or minus 5, and you can find Cahokian settlements even beyond that into like the next river valley out, but they start dropping off. I mean, it's really clear that obviously, you know, you have a city, you've got the most important farmers right next to the city, and then you have the next most important farmers, you know, in this band 15 miles out, and then even less important farmers beyond that, right?
I see. So,
yeah, you're probably looking at a 50 mile radius farming phenomenon. Plenty of food for Cahokia.
It's not hard to imagine. Yeah, I totally understand that land seems very rich and verdant. So is this Richland farming complex materially, does it appear to be subordinate to Cahokia in the archaeological record?
Yes. Now, subordinate in a soft way, though.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of, they would necessarily think of themselves as subordinate, or maybe there was a lot of collaboration and they were receiving benefits. So maybe they were quite happy with this relationship, but there are real measures, especially from this immigrant village, that they were not eating as well as Cahokians were eating, and that they were not receiving, didn't have access to all the good raw materials that farmers closer to Cahokia had access to. So they were more marginal. And so they were paying some kind of price. So, but you could, you know, I think you say they were subordinate. Yes.
Okay.
At the same time, another line of evidence is, and there's Cahokian administrators out there as well to make sure that they were producing food, right? So however they did that, it may have been through religion, like, you know, hey, let's all get together, we'll have a ceremony, and then go home and make sure you produce that food. but yeah, that unequal relationship is there.
That is absolutely fascinating. So I want to now turn our scope of our conversation more towards what the Cahokians themselves would have been up to. What kind of games did they play to entertain themselves? I know that you have done a lot of work on the game Chunky, and I was curious if you could give us a little bit of information about what it is and what it meant for Cahokians.
So Chunky is a game that was played all the way into the early 1800s. And it's a game that spreads. And the archaeology of Chunky is clear cut. The game is invented as a game involving a stone roller, like a hockey puck that you roll. It's invented as early, a little before 600. Now, that game itself, and I'll explain what the rules are and stuff in a minute, possibly a version of a much older game, which is a simple kid's game of hoop and pole, where you take a stick and you have a wooden hoop and you kind of roll it, and kids, you know, probably the rules are probably pretty flexible. You control the hoop and you control the stick and somehow you score points. But at 600 AD, long before Cahokia, you start seeing this game with stone rolling discs in villages of the later woodland period. And and only between about central to northern Illinois along the Mississippi River down to just a little bit south of Cahokia, maybe down around the confluence of the Ohio. And that's where the game must have been invented. So where's Cahokia? It's kind of in the middle of that distribution. So you find these chunky stones pre-Cahokia in these village courtyards. But then the interesting thing that happens is at 1050, the game looks to have become official. And maybe somebody takes control of it. And it becomes, kids are probably still playing it, but there's an official version that involves an official Cahokia-made roller, the chunky stone. And what we don't see are chunky sticks. In fact, Chunky is actually named after the sticks or the throwing javelin-like things.
Okay.
Yeah. So the game then it probably was played by teens at Cahokia. Later in time, when people like George Catlin describe it out on the plains, it's played between usually two men who represent, the different interests or different communities. And the two men would have the rolling stone and the other man would have sticks. And so one guy would roll it and then the two men would throw their sticks after it, javelin style, to try to score points by getting your stick near where the stone stops. And then over a period of rolls back and forth across some open ground, you would score points and whoever won, would win whatever they were gambling over, which could be serious, contact people would, that is in the early 1800s, in this sort of later contact era, they'd be betting their kids and wives and stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But so that,
high stakes.
Yeah. And who knows? Stakes could have been higher at early Cahokia. We don't really know. We do find those official stones carefully curated, probably in medicine bundles, and occasionally buried with important people at Cahokia, almost exclusively at Cahokia. I'm sorry. So the last thing I would add is that Cahokians travel, as I mentioned. What do you find wherever they go? You find their chunky stones that they take with them that are made out of rock that you can trace back to around Cahokia itself.
Wow.
So part of their mission seems to be to go out there and also to introduce other people to their version of this game of Chunky.
Do you think that there was any ritual or ceremonial significance in playing Chunky?
Oh, so much of what people did in the past had a ceremonial dimension to it. And that includes, things from how you make a pot and add shell temper. I mean, I think that shell temper was very meaningful about the origin stories. And so in a way you could think of a pot as having a ritual even an ordinary cooking pot is having some kind of ritual significance while you're using it, you know, with your family all around. So Chunky, for sure. I'm sure there was unofficial versions that kids continue to play because you find little Chunky stones lots of places. But that official version, I think, must have had much more meaning. So when elites or important families got together to play this, especially in a in a plaza in the say Cahokia, you know, the stakes are always going to be high. It's going to be like, well, who is favored, you know, by the gods and who's not? And that could have been the question they were trying to resolve, you know, by playing the game. And so then the game would be having, and we know this from records early on, when people, when European explorers asked about Chunky, like they would get answers that said like, well, you know, this represents the movement of the solar disk across the sky, you know, and that's the role of the Chunky across the ground. I'm sure it was even more complicated than that in terms of the ritual and ceremonial references.
Want to get more involved in local archaeology? At ARI, we identify, preserve, and responsibly explore archaeological sites in Southeast Indiana, Southwestern Ohio, and Northern Kentucky. Our volunteers are one of the driving forces behind this mission, from participating in archaeological digs, assisting in lab work, artifact processing, and supporting field trips and fundraising. Every role helps us move forward. With just a one-hour training, you'll gain new skills, meet new people, enjoy nature, and make a real impact. Volunteering with ARI means joining a community passionate about history and preserving it for generations to come. Join us at ARI. Be a part of history. Be a part of the future.
Gotcha. So I'm actually really interested in how once you have the start of Cahokia and you have these different peoples from different parts of the country, different part of the land, as you said, from Missouri, kind of coalescing on Cahokia, how their culture, their material culture changed. Did the quality of the things that they made improve? Were there regional influences where there wasn't before from other parts of the country, like these people were coming from?
It's been, as you might imagine, because archaeologists love this kind of stuff, there's been a lot of work on that very question. And so I can't claim to have done much myself to change with, but Cahokia is unique in terms of the amount of standardization that they introduce into the way people make things. And that's just a function of the size. You know, like there's a lot of people there and there's a central authority. And for big ceremonial events, the central authority is going to want people to make stuff to bring in, you know, to service that particular ritual event, let's say. So you, in so doing, you could say, if you're the authority, like, hey, you know, X, Y, and Z families over there are really good potters. Would you make me some special pots and maybe make them black this time, you know, and so I can use them for the ceremony. Over enough ceremonies, you end up creating specialists that way. You know, you end up saying like, oh, okay, there's a whole group of potters now 50 years on who are really good. We're going to use their pots for these ceremonies. So that in short order, you see diverse pre-Cahokian traditions, whether it's making lithic tools and arrowheads, you know, or it's making pots, become standardized. So that all of a sudden you go 50 years in and by 1100, like material culture is really homogenous and it's nice. It's very well made. So it's likely that, you know, most people are not making pots anymore. Most people are not making arrowheads anymore. Instead, they're turning their attention to farming. And so if they need an arrowhead through their connections, maybe they can get one, or they get gift. You know, these things become gifts, and even the central authority might be doling out gifts that way to ensure allegiance, you know, of farmers. Yeah. So other later Mississippian societies, whether it's Angel in Indiana or Moundville in Alabama, whatever, you see the same kind of thing happen over the course of their the rise and fall, if you will. Mm-hmm. Just not quite the same scale that you see at Cahokia.
So you mentioned that there are about three precincts of Cahokia, and I'm curious, at its zenith, was the city diversified in its three precincts? So, for example, were there more potters in one part of the city, or was there a certain amount of political power that was associated with a particular precinct from which the ruling elites of Cahokia lived?
Yes. And let me start by acknowledging, I think I was probably just starting my career when, I met the, Carrie Wilson, who's an elder now with the Quapaw Nation. Mm-hmm. And she challenged my thinking of Cahokia by making me think about those precincts as possible places where you have different ethnic groups emerge, mm-hmm. each precinct. And or maybe, you know, the whole reason you have three is because they were different to start with. Mm. Anyway, I just want to say that this, what I think, has definitely been influenced by what she and other descendants think or were thinking about at some point. Mm. And then so I went and looked at some of the archaeological evidence over the years, you know, occasionally. And yeah, you do have some differences between those precincts. The biggest one is each of those precincts has a different design and that's oriented in a slightly different direction. So they are aligning themselves with something that the other one is not. Mm. And usually that's celestial or cosmic. You know, it's the moon or the Milky Way versus another star or the sun, you know, at another precinct. That's huge. So they're already at the beginning. These precincts have some kind of underlying difference in the fundamental alignment, you know, of human bodies to some other different cosmic referent.
Wow.
And then on top of that, you do see that, there seems to be certain things made, at least in some neighborhoods in one of these precincts, that aren't made in other neighborhoods and other precincts, and information to be a little spotty at Cahokia, mm-hmm. weaving. So the people at one neighborhood at Cahokia, they have a lot of spindle whorls, and they're probably making a lot of fiber thread that then may be used to weave. And you don't see that in other, like, say, East St. Louis. And East St. Louis, this is a loss. We don't really know much about St. Louis. And I think, and this is really spotty, that you have some evidence for southeastern Missouri migrants at East St. Louis, but you have much more evidence for them at Cahokia. So it's like, there's probably even an ethnic difference or a different ethnic mix at these different precincts that we just don't really understand well yet because so much was destroyed, you know?
Yeah.
One cool thing that to add with the St. Louis precinct. So imagine you have Cahokia to the east, kind of sprawls down into East St. Louis on the Mississippi River, and then right across from East St. Louis on the other side, you have St. Louis. Mm-hmm. That happens to be a location where the mounds, at least some of the mounds of 26 there, were built over the top of cave openings. Wow. So that precinct might have been much more about connecting to ancestors in the underworld than the other precincts were. So the answer to your question is affirmative. But it's still something that it's a hard one to understand.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm guessing that the St. Louis precinct has not been preserved very well.
No. Oh. Over the years, since the last mound was taken away after the Civil War, the European builders of St. Louis lowered the ground surface. Oh. So since then, like the 70s through now, there's been a couple of times when archaeologists monitoring like a water line or something will find a slight lens, maybe a redeposited Cahokian material, but not much. It's pretty much obliterated. Even to the point that then St. Louisans filled in these underground caves with debris. So they're completely filled up.
So I wanted to ask you about social hierarchy and social stratification throughout Cahokia's history. So you mentioned that at the beginning, there was examples of a hierarchy, but that it wasn't as pronounced. And I'm curious if as time went on, did the wealth inequality and disparity of resources increase as Cahokia's history went on?
So we know by 1100, and this is based on excavations in the mid-2000s ahead of highway realignments, right, at East St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And now we confirm that in some of the Richland Complex stuff. We know that we have Cahokians who have an extraordinary number of buildings and mounds and storage. So the buildings in these Cahokian, let's call them household areas of East St. Louis, of the high status Cahokian household areas, many more buildings, incredible amounts of potential to store food, but not many people, like it's just like a family living in the middle of this high status religious, you know, landscape with mounds and public buildings and big posts. And then when you move, and there's another good example out in the Richland Complex, like a piece of East St. Louis, like carved out and plopped on top of a high hill to overlook farmers, you know, down below, they have all those same trappings of these elaborate, spacious buildings, temples, storehouses, bundle houses, and domestic quarters that are a little bit bigger than other Cahokian, than other people. It looks like they just have access and control over food. Like just the farmers must be giving them food and they have the ability to store it in these houses. And if you look out to other Cahokians, especially farmers, but even neighborhoods at Cahokia itself, their people are more ordinary and they don't have all the storage potential.
Yeah.
So I guess what I'm saying is I think we've managed to identify Cahokia's elites. And it's less in terms of how they dress themselves or how they were buried. I mean, there's important burials, but it's much more in terms of they are controlling the economy, you know, the farming economy and this flow of surplus. Who they get it first, and then they can dole it out how they want, or just eat it all themselves. And you see that from about 1100 to about 1150, they're there. After 1150, well, maybe 1200, then they go away. You don't see those overbuilt and underused residential sections of a city anymore. So it looks to me like you have this, you have the Big Bang, you know, you have Cahokia developing at 1050 and then they're building it 50 years or less. By 1100, it's done. And then you have Cahokia elite for maybe 100 years. They're not oppressing people, I don't think, but they're in control.
Yeah.
And then by 1200, another big change happens and things are reconstructed and downsized. And the opulence of life for those earlier families seems to go away.
So I know that around 1150, massive wooden palisades were erected in Cahokia. So how do you see that in the context of what you just told me? Is that an example of internal unrest or external unrest? And how does that signify a change in Cahokian history?
Yes, I think it's hard to know what's internal and external here. Internal, people who have moved out or maybe have formed their own colonies, even if it's 50 to 100 miles north, might still think of themselves as Cahokians and might say, my birthright is to have some share of this big pie. I don't know. We don't really know very well. But the wall seems to coincide with the beginning of the depopulation of the Cahokia region, meaning those farmers out in that Richland complex, those farmers clearly leave and they go away. Wow. We don't know where. Some might go to Cahokia, some might just leave the whole region. Funny, then that's when you see the walls go up. So I think what Cahokians are really trying to do is hang on to a shrinking pie. Mm. And the wall is both defensive and maybe more likely it's offensive. That is, how do you hang on to a shrinking pie? You try to get rid of your competitors up and down the river by actively going and assaulting them. And there is some evidence for this. St. Genevieve, Missouri is a really good case where this big town is attacked and burned and goes away. And it's the closest big competitor to Cahokia. And I would bet it's Cahokians. And so the wall then means that you can send a bunch of warriors down south and not worry about being attacked yourself while those warriors are gone. Because you can just leave a few archers manning that wall, and anybody who's smart, clever enough to try to counterattack is not going to be successful. So I think that's what that wall is. Yeah.
And so is this coinciding with any kind of environmental change in the region as this was going on? I know that in the past that environmental change has been used as one of the only explanations for Cahokia's decline and dispersal. But now that we know a little bit more about what was going on politically and socially, possibly in Cahokia, how does the environmental situation play into this story?
Yeah, I think the confusion in the past and the arguments were a bit too black and white. It's that, it's either, the environment is causing the collapse or not. And what was overlooked is that you don't have to have people overexploiting their environment for it to be a problem if you get an environmental shift that's going to affect production in some ways. It could just introduce a little bit of doubt in people's minds, like, my cousin who lives in, 100 miles away is doing fine. Here we're having droughts. Like, what does that mean in terms of the way the Cahokians are favored or not by the water gods? So I think because people have beliefs about natural things as if they're gods at this period of time, like everybody did in the past, but the Cahokia, that's likely what was going on. So the farmers could vote with their feet saying, I'm not sure I feel good about this. I'm going to leave. Mm. And Cahokians could basically start suffering as a result. Like, well, you can't pull in as much food anymore for these big grand festivals. Another strategy becomes then to exert your political might or your military might outwards to compensate for the fact that you're shrinking, the economy shrinking back home. And yes, and those droughts start mid 1100s, and they're significant. I mean, you look at the models that have been done based on tree rings, and the Cahokia region could suffer some significant droughts, even if it wasn't enough to make people starve. It could be enough for them to start rethinking the way they are dealing with the outside world. And it continues.
And I would imagine that food, which had been given so enthusiastically in previous generations, was now becoming absolutely necessary and essential. And the Cahokians were...
In a way, their success is the cause of their demise, right? It's like, we're so successful, you can support these elites and all their stored food. And yet at some point, people are going to say, no, it's not working for me anymore.
I guess I don't know much about the research of urbanism in other parts of the world to really speak with a lot of confidence about this, but it's interesting that there were other cities in other parts of the world where the elites were able to secure their grip and kind of convince people to buy into their ideology of this is why you should give me your surplus for X, Y, or Z reason, why it failed, that project failed in Cahokia, where in other parts of the world, that wasn't necessarily the fate, just a random thought.
Well, I'll give you a random thought back. I don't think on a city by city basis, Cahokia is necessarily that unique in terms of overall trajectory of people getting disillusioned after a brilliant start that's based on religion and belief and everything's great. And then it kind of wears away. Mm. What's odd, And lots of other parts of the world, is you don't just usually have one city. You will have a network of cities that develop. And so if one city then goes down because of disillusioned population, those farmers shift over to another city maybe even just a few days away. And then the whole cycle might continue or restart, you know. Cahokia is like this one big city. And then when it goes down, like, that's it.
Yeah.
It may be the severity of the collapse that leads people to say no more and say, let's just get far away from this place. It could be its northern latitude is a bit too far north. So when you get a little bit of climate change, like, corn really is becoming difficult to grow. And so you've got to go pretty far south to get into good corn country again for a while, at least, or over into Fort Ancient, which, you know, the climate is actually stays better over there than it does at Cahokia.
What do veterans and archaeology have in common? More than you think. At ARI, we created Valor, the Veteran Archaeological Learning Opportunities and Research Program, to give veterans a new mission, uncovering the past while building their future. Through real-world excavations, lab work, and public interpretation, Valor provides hands-on training and experience that can lead to meaningful careers in archaeology and cultural resource management. Valor is more than just training. It's a chance to find community, purpose, and a new direction after service. Ready to dig in? Learn more at exploreari.org/valor and make archaeology your next adventure.
But that's the kind of the big difference. It's like this whole big system seems to go down when Cahokia goes down for a big chunk of the continent. And in other urban areas, you get the same rise and fall, but the whole thing doesn't go down.
So I did want to make sure to ask you, because I know that religion was, and the ritual life of Cahokians was so important to the Cahokian project. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about what we know about the mythology and the beliefs of the people of Cahokia. What can we tell about their mythologies and ontologies?
That's one of my favorite questions, of course, more lately, because I think a lot about that now.
Yeah.
So 10 years ago, my answer would have been different, and 20 years, even much different. I suspect, because you can look deep into the past and you can see hints of spiritual powers, you know, in the, say, Hopewell, you know, they're carving things in terms of their understanding of what's powerful out there in the spiritual world or the one that they're a part of. Mm-hmm. And some of those things you could, as an outside observer, kind of say like, well, that god's kind of similar to this carving that we have in the Mississippian period. So maybe it's the same belief in the same kind of, you know, storm god or what have you, or underworld serpent god. Or I think that's it's really tricky and probably a little deceptive, because I think all human societies through time end up reinventing their gods. And so you look back and you say, I'm still a Christian because look, I believe I have the cross, and look, there's a cross like 2000 years ago. Mm. Yeah. But so much has changed, you know, so many other things have changed along the way that your Christianity is not the same as what early Christians were doing. And I suspect that's like Cahokia. Cahokia is reinventing traditional beliefs and reinvigorating them and probably sharpening the outlines of certain gods, possibly in conjunction with the fact that they know more. They're exploring the world now up and down the river. They might even go into Mesoamerica, or at least they met people who did. They may be adopting or putting a Mesoamerican spin on some of these traditional gods. So a basic god in the Americas is a storm god. They're everywhere, of course, because you get thunderstorms and they're impressive. And you think, okay, there's something alive in the sky and it brings rain and we need to respect that. So all people might have a generic belief in some kind of storm god, but I'm betting Cahokians are putting a unique spin on that and making it more of an official god based on what they then learn at the beginning of their construction of their city. Right. And I suspect there's names that they're attaching. And I'm betting that some of those are Mesoamerican names, because they're kind of saying, like, look, you all believe in a storm god, but here's the storm god. It's the one that I, you know, here's the new rituals that come with the storm god now, and we need to build new temples to this new version of the storm god. Mm. So what I suspect is going on, and I, you know, that's what I argue in that last book.
Right.
Gods of Thunder. Yeah.
So do you see this storm god as being the primary god of Cahokia that was revered by Cahokians, a kind of patron god, or was he just an important god amongst many?
If we take a Mesoamerica mythology as a model, you do have some gods that are more central to the overall creation and maintenance of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then other lots of peripheral gods who work with those central gods. So there are creator gods. You can even go to descendants today, or certainly say the ethnography of the early, you know, 1700s, 1800s. You can kind of parse those gods out and say, okay, this serpent god, you know, this is really important. Serpent god can also be the thunder god in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's no reason to think there's only one or two gods, but there is reason to think that there are these central ones. Yes. A water god, a storm god, a feminine fertility god, a goddess, which is carved by Cahokians, you know, all over the place.
Wow.
But there's more. You know there's got to be more because, even today or in the recent past, it's not just, there are lots of spiritual powers and people identify them, even if they're not formalized and demarcated as the gods, there's still these spiritual powers that can gain or lose their power based on what happens in the world of people.
So where do these gods kind of show up in the material record? Are they showing up on effigy pots or other sort of stone artifacts? Where are you getting this information on these deities in the material record?
Yeah, what you just mentioned, effigy pots, carvings, stone carvings. Mississippian folks across the South do, you know, engage in various kinds of ways of materializing the gods. Pottery is an easy one, you know, and then that's also a connection often with, they'll show ancestors. So ancestors could be intermediaries, you know, between people, living people, and the dead and the gods of the netherworld. I think it's also something that we need to think much more about in terms of where else do they show up. It's not just in artifacts. It's in the designs of these places. So Cahokia is, like a few other places, pretty clearly now, I think, aligned to both the Milky Way and the moon, and both things appearing at the night, and then just much lesser extent the sun. So what does that say about people's beliefs? Okay, so like foregrounding the land of the dead and nighttime, especially at Cahokia. And if you go to another place somewhere else in the South, Kincaid in Illinois or Angel, let's say, you might have the same kind of emphasis on a nighttime god, like the owl is really big in those two sites, owls, but it's a different spin than it was at Cahokia. You go to Etowah, and it's about the morning star character, you know, or this eagle warrior, a falcon man, like, again, a slightly different spin. So it's like, it's based on a similar background belief system, but a religions change through time and people, because people are using them to reinvent themselves at a new place, you know, as they go through history.
So I know that there are figures such as the underwater panther that kind of pop up in and around the Midwest. Is that something that also shows up in the material record at Cahokia?
It does. So it's one of the, it is that central god, that you do see, like, in some way materialized from Hopewell, if not before, like Poverty Point, all the way, you know, through Cahokia. But there, it varies. It's just, it's there, but again, it's like different spins and probably different associations as it goes. Cahokia gets associated with corn agriculture. Yeah. So that you can then look later at the Pawnee, various Pawnee groups, And you can, their narratives, as they just, it looks like what's carved at Cahokia, like, you know, the serpent tail splits into two and it becomes vines. Yeah. And that's later. That's not that, you don't see that like earlier. So it's again, this reinvention of a basic god over and over and over.
That's absolutely fascinating. It's so interesting to see how religious motifs and individuals and deities kind of evolve through the ages and are kind of changed to fit the ideas and needs of the people through time. Now, I wanted to switch more towards discussing Cahokia's kind of end and dispersal. So after about 1250, is that when we can kind of say that there is some sort of abandonment of the site? And can you just give us a little bit of an idea about what that looked like? So was it a gradual decline or was it abrupt, kind of like its formation?
Not like its formation, although there could have been a series of abrupt steps as it's being deconstructed and downsized. And so the first step is that one that we already talked about, 1150, when some farmers leave and the walls go up. That's clearly a step. It's not the collapse, if you will. It's an attempt to hold it together. Mm-hmm. There's another one of those that seems to come around 1200, maybe a little after 1200, 1210, 1220. Mm-hmm. And that is a change in the way the festivals might have worked. So you see a shift in pot styles and maybe who's making the pots. Mm-hmm. You return to kind of plainer, normal ware, less fancy pots. Mm. And you know, more by this time, you know, Cahokia has been downsized quite a bit. So it's a much smaller place, 5,000 people, maybe. Mm. And then you see yet more at 1250, there is maybe a series of closures, you know, and or more depopulation. So it does play out over time. And it's almost like, would they have even thought of this as decline? Or they would have thought of this as an attempt to hold it together and, you know, reinvigorate it and reinvent it all again. And it just doesn't hang together. Mm. Then by 1350, it's empty, but we've really underthought how descendants at that time might still have been going back occasionally.
Yeah.
Much like the people do in other parts of North America, you know, make pilgrimages back to old sites.
Yeah.
Certainly today, that's what descendant communities are doing, actively doing. And I would wonder if it wasn't done in by people who could, even at this earlier date. And by the time George Rogers Clark waltzes into the American bottom, you know, this patch of floodplain, he sees Cahokia and he asks the local Illini Confederacy chief, what's with this? Like, who built these? And that man has an answer for George Rogers Clark. And he says, these are the palaces of our forefathers, you know, when they were as numerous as the trees in the woods. Wow. So there's some memory there. Even if it's indirect or stories passed in different directions, there's still a sense of this was ours and we know the stories. And so abandonment's a tough word, it turns out.
Yeah.
It's like, depopulation is definitely a better word.
So that actually segues really nicely into the question that I was about to ask, which is, so after its decline and dispersal, what was the cultural legacy that Cahokia kind of passed on? So in the immediate aftermath of Cahokia, were people using Cahokian style pots? What was the kind of cultural aftermath of the Cahokian phenomenon?
Really good question. And it's always hard to get beyond the archaeological assumptions that clutter my head and other archaeologists and maybe are wrong. And there's active work happening right now, you know, and I know at the University of Illinois, folks that I used to be a part of that and direct that organization is actively working with the descendant communities to try to reconnect some of these linkages and to look at pottery and say, hey, boy, this pottery looks kind of Cahokian. Maybe it looks a little angel or whatever, and start rebuilding are rethinking that whole narrative that is about collapse and abandonment and disconnection. Mm. And that said, there are frightfully few stories that anybody but maybe like some knowledge holder somewhere might still have. But otherwise, there's very few stories of Cahokia that make reference to a place that you think that might have been Cahokia. Interestingly, Pawnee have one. And you read it, and this is being advocated by a scholarly descendant. It's like, that's really interesting. Like, yes, that could really be Cahokia. But and there's definitely pottery among certain descendants that people are still actively making now. They're like, oh my God, I think that could be in a lineage that you could trace back to Cahokia. But we have we've lost the links. And so we're just now trying to, along, you know, in collaboration with indigenous descendants, trying to rethink it. And I guess that's about as good as I can do for you.
Right. Well, now I'm kind of interested, and I've got a follow-up question to that. So you mentioned that there were other sites that have clear Cahokian influences. So did those sites get abandoned after that initial entrenchment after 1150, or did they have some sort of further legacy after that? What was the, I would imagine it's hard to parse together its relationship to the mother city, as it were, Cahokia, but what were the fate of those sites in the wake of Cahokia's decline?
Let me give you two examples, and these two that I've worked at, I know my grad students have worked at, and they will give you extremes. So the one, which is a great place up in western Wisconsin, in the little town of Trempealeau, Wisconsin. And there's a beautiful little Cahokian shrine complex with mounds, one central mound and some other ones at the end of two little causeways on top of a bluff. We worked there in conjunction with the Ho-Chunk Nation, actually. And all we found was three spurts of Cahokian occupation. It's all Cahokian. Like, most local people look to have run away when Cahokians arrived. They're not engaging the Cahokians. Wow. And that place seems to last from a little bit before 1050 to the late 1000s, and that's it. And then Cahokians never go back, and it's left to sit alone. So that's one extreme. And then the other extreme is to the south, down in Carson, the Carson site in Mississippi, where one of my last grad students is doing her dissertation work. Cool site because it starts off as a Hopewell site with these mounds. Yeah, so it's with these weird biconical mounds that are on a lunar alignment. So it's like Hopewell, you know, this broad sharing of cosmic knowledge they shared from Ohio to Mississippi, this notion, this idea of the long lunar cycle.
Yeah.
So then it's abandoned or deep, you know, nobody's living there. Living human beings are living there for a while.
Yeah.
The next people who show up are Cahokians, and they show up, it's dated around 1075 or so. And they show up in their little houses, you know, in their little neighborhood arrangements. And like the one in Wisconsin, they seem to kind of come and go. And they'll be gone for a while and then come back and rebuild their houses and then go away for a while and come back. There, however, it seems to roll into a Mississippian town. So I'm not sure if it's the Cahokian stay or if other people kind of crowd around the Cahokians and then they start building Mississippian flat top mounds at this Carson site. And that lasts then all the way till a late Mississippian town with a wall around it on the same grounds. Dated around 1400 or so. Cahokians are just kind of in the middle of this long historical trajectory.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Was there a lasting kind of cultural impact that these first Cahokians had on this site after Cahokia's dispersal and decline?
That's what I'm hoping my grad student can answer for me. So the answer is yes, maybe, right now.
I've just got one more question, and then we can wrap things up. So I'm sure that you've got your finger on the pulse of all things Cahokia when it comes to research or preservation. So I'm curious, what would you like to be done more? So where would you like more research to be done or more attention to be spent on this amazing site?
Great place to end, because I think enough is preserved of the original Cahokia city, and in agreement with the wishes of most tribal folks these days, it's like, we don't really need to go to Cahokia to do much more right now, because it's not being impacted. It's I mean, not all of it's preserved, but, you know, a good chunk of it is. And why work at a preserved site?
Right.
Especially a sacred place that descendants don't necessarily want you to just be randomly digging around. What's being damaged? Through climate change now, and a lot of the modeling we were doing at the University of Illinois is showing, like, we're losing this outer tier of sites that we started working on because of developers building housing developments. But now some of the sites that are left are enduring increased intense rain, and you're getting amplified erosional issues. And the farmers are continuing to keep plowing after you have erosion. So the sites are slowly degrading, and some sites have no more time left. Some sites have a decade or two left until you're finally, the farmer plows all the way through the cultural deposits. Those are the places that we need to be working at, and also then trying to preserve in tandem, because I'm not convinced we're going to preserve those at all. I think most of them are going to go, but we should try. Yeah. But I don't think politically it's just not in the cards right now to put money into buying land. So we got to retrieve some data from those, and that's where field schools should be focused. The last few years when I was myself actively in the field with research money was at the Emerald site, this big hilltop shrine out in the Richland complex. It's doesn't have much time left. It's a hill, and it erodes every year, and the farmers kind of plow up and down it, and it's just all washing away. I think what we need, and we've talked with the state about this in Illinois, like, you need a plan. Like, which ones are we likely to lose that aren't going to be bought? Why don't we try to develop some kind of consortium, you know, of researchers and try to get little pieces, researchers and tribes who also want to preserve these sites, and develop a plan. And we don't have that plan yet. And that's what we need.
I agree. That is a great place to end. People, archaeologists, and I think members of the public should all be concerned with the preservation of these extremely important sites and priceless cultural heritage. So with that being said, Dr. Pockettat, thank you so much for sitting down and speaking with me today.
Thank you. And thank everybody who was listening.